Blog Talk Radio.
Zimmerman shooting. We hope this song didn't offend anyone, but this speaks volumes to the news in our society today. This case has been covered in the press from start to finish and then some. This is a very emotional incident, and the press is still playing on emotions more than giving the facts. And Really, it's creating extra drama in the process. As a nation, all people have the right to protest things that they don't agree with, but on the other hand, using violence and damaging property as a protest is wrong. Doing this doesn't help build change to this type of situation. There's enough drama when you take into account that a 17-year-old man is young man has been shot and killed. He had his entire life before him, and now he's dead. There is no way that this is not a bad situation. How does a family cope with this? We have some clips that we want to share with you to help you see some of the drama and hear the total message of what's been presented in soundbite form. You be the judge of the soundbites you've heard and compare them to the entire statement. Sometimes soundbites are twisted to make a point. We have to point out that we do have a black president. Wild Bill has some questions for you. One, if you had control, what do you think we could do to keep things like this from happening in the future? And two, if you were the jury, what would have been your vote? And third, as people of faith, do we have a responsibility to make a difference? And how should we do this? Matt Maddox gave us the numbers of how kids without fathers in low-income homes make up the majority of those in prison. Do we have a calling to this situation, or do we play the blame game like everyone else? And now we're going to start with the clips and hear some questions from you afterward.
Well, hello, Starlin. Thank you so much for getting our show kicked off tonight, and hello to all of you out there in Blog Talk Radio Land. We're discussing with you the shooting of Trayvon Martin. Unless you've had your head buried in the sand, we're all very much aware of how that Mr. Zimmerman was acquitted and how that the press has been covering this incident, how that even during the case and after the case, the race card has now came out and shown its ugly head, how that, you know, we had to be very aware that this was just a 17-year-old young man that was shot and killed. And that's sad. You know, he had his whole life before him. He had parents. It's one of those things that I don't know how to put it into words, but we can learn from things past, or we can take things and we can paint pictures. And the press is famous for taking things and turning it into a media circus. I guess it's good for ratings. I've actually, through working in law enforcement, I've been a victim of this a couple of times in my life, and it's one of those things that it is. I think it is not good for our country. I'm thankful that we live in a country where people can protest. You have a right to opinion, but the riots that are taking place in the streets, some of the things that are being said, the soundbite mentality that all of you know that I hate. I don't know. It's one of those things that it really stirs me, and I thought it would be a great topic for our show. One of the things that I do want to say that this brought back memories of an incident with the Rodney King beatings. And for those of you that are young people in our audience, you may not know who Rodney King was, but he was a black man that back in March of 1991 became famous because somebody videotaped where the police were trying to arrest him, and it became a physical altercation. You can look back at that, and you're going to find all kinds of different aspects of this, and you can take your own opinion. Having been a police officer, having been trained in a police academy where you understand firsthand of how many officers in the United States of America have been killed with their own weapon, how you're trained that anytime you're involved in a physical altercation, that you're to treat it as an armed altercation because you have a weapon. These things are part of who I am. So my perception of this is different. Just like the perception of a black person is going to be different on this case with the shooting with Trayvon versus how a white person would look at this when you get talking about race. when you get to looking at maybe someone that's been a victim of a crime, how they're going to look at this compared to someone that's, you know, has been sheltered and been fortunate to never been a victim of a crime. Perception is very, very powerful in how we look at things. I've been very, I guess the word is offended, in how some of the religious shows have taken sound bites of things that the president had to say and try to paint his comments into saying something, I think, again, different than what it was intended to be. That being said, though, I believe in this country that when you go through our court system, that when you're found innocent of a charge, that that should be the end of it. As we saw with the Rodney King incident, the officers that were involved in these charges, it was dismissed at the state level, and how the federal court system got involved because of race riots, or maybe I shouldn't say race riots, but riots in the street over the verdict. And I don't believe that should happen. And there's been talk again of federal courts coming in to look at this. There's been look at some of the laws that are there in the state of Florida where the shooting took place, where, you know, where you don't have to back up. You know, where you can stand your ground, I think is how they're wording it. And but that really wasn't a part of what happened in this case. And when you look back at the incident with Rodney King, here you had a man that was 6'3", a huge man, was known to the police. He was involved in a high-speed chase where he wrecked his car and they got him stopped and it became a physical altercation. It looks bad on the video because you see all the other policemen that come up behind you, see the other police cars. When you're trained and your total focus is on what's right there in front of you, and the police departments at that time, your training was until someone submitted to being handcuffed, then you did whatever you had to do. You were taught to go after areas like wrist, elbows, collarbones, knees, ankles, those top places where you could strike someone that would cause severe pain to make them, you know, submit to where you could handcuff them and take them in. When you go through training with pepper spray or a stun gun or with a taser, you don't realize this, but policemen actually have to have these things. You use them on each other during your training, so you understand what type of reaction is supposed to take place. Here you had a huge man, strong. The policemen are armed. They hit him with a taser. He didn't go down like a normal person would. It was clear that this man was high on drugs and he was, you know, on alcoholic, or he was drunk. This man had been, he was on parole for robbery, you know, all these things, and it turned around to where all of a sudden he was the victim. And I do think that things went a little extreme on what happened there, but I can also understand when you got this huge man who is not submitting, who has been known to, has actually hurt police officers in the past who were trying to arrest him, you have a tendency to become a little bit more excessive in trying to take control of a situation. Like, I'm not trying to justify what they did, but here you have a young man, in this case here with Trevon, 17-year-old boy is now dead. He's got family. It's not like a police show that this is going to be over. We have Mr. Zimmerman, who is only 28 years old, who we've taken hour after hour after hour and tried to break down his actions, his comments, on what he said right after this. He went through a five-hour interrogation at the police department. And we have time to try to break down something that happened where he just had a few moments. Mr. Zimmerman was part of a neighborhood watch. He wanted to be a police officer to the point that he got a college education, had a criminal justice degree, and he took what he did very serious. It's very clear from the telephone calls and previous experience he had with the police department and his position, that he was very professional in what he did, that he wasn't one of these people just Mr. Gung-Ho going out there like some of the press tried to paint it. He had actually been involved in situations before where he called the police on a non-emergency number, reported suspicious people to be there, and when the police got there, the people were gone. And then later, these same people that he could identify were actually proved to be involved in some of the burglaries that took place with the apartment complex where he was working. Mr. Zimmerman is Hispanic mix. There was nothing as far as in the recordings that showed that there was anything prejudicial in the manner in what he said or how he dealt with this. When you looked at this apartment complex, it's a gated community, 260 units. It's actually, they called them townhomes. 49% of the people that are white, 23% Hispanic, 20% black, 5% Asian. So it wasn't something where profiling was taking place. During 6 months previous to this incident, the police had been called on non-emergency number 402 times to come out there. This is before the shooting. Five of these calls previous to this in the 6 months had been by Mr. Zimmerman in regard to suspicious people. There had actually been 8 burglaries that had taken place in this apartment complex, 9 thefts, and there had been 1 shooting before this incident happened. So there was crime taking place here. Here you have a man that's following a young black man. He's already called the police, reported that this man's walking along, got his hands around his waist. It's raining outside, unusual weather for someone to be walking. Said he was kind of looked like he was looking around, you know, some of the apartments. He didn't recognize him as belonging there. And so he's following him. He's called the police. He's tired of these people getting away. And so you can, in the recording, you can hear his door chime where he actually gets out of his car. He's following this person. The police ask him, "Sir, are you following this person?" And he says, "Yes." And they said, "Don't do that." And he says, "Okay." His testimony was he was going back to his car. All of a sudden, the reason he had got out of his car in the first place was because all of a sudden the young man started running. And so, but anyway, he responds, says, "Okay," he's walking back to his car, and all of a sudden he's being attacked. Now, the way they worded it first, it wasn't start off with attack. The man confronts him, wants to know what he's doing, and then all of a sudden it goes to a physical altercation. You can look at the pictures. It looks like Mr. Zimmerman's nose is broke. It's definitely very swollen. There's blood on his face. There's blood on the back of his head from where his head was busted open, or he had a cut from where he had contact with the ground. People are calling the police department on 911. In the background from their calls, you can hear a man calling for help, which turns out to be Mr. Zimmerman, which he testified that he had called for help several times. 8 different people called in, and you could hear Mr. Zimmerman's voice in the background screaming for help. And finally, during this incident, Mr. Zimmerman pulls his weapon and he shoots this young man and kills him. Sad situation all the way around. But the media circus, well, let me give you an example, something from my past. It was after midnight. It's on a Friday night. It's cold outside. It's probably in the 30s. Not freezing. It had been raining earlier. It was misting rain at this point. I meet a car coming into town that is speeding at least 15 miles an hour over the speed limit. I can't remember the exact speed, but I didn't write speeding citations for less than 15 miles an hour over the speed limit. I didn't want people to say that I was running a speed trap. I felt 15 miles an hour over was a good number to be cut and dried on speeding. This car pulls over on a side street. I approach the car. It's a well-dressed black man. He hands me his driver's license. I let him know that I stopped him for speeding. I'll be back with him in just a minute. There's several other people in the car. There's another. There's a black woman in the front seat, very well-dressed. She comes out of her car. She's screaming at me. She's beating on the side of my car. It's very cold outside, and so I decide just to ignore her. She doesn't have a purse. It's clear she doesn't have a weapon. She's not going to hurt me hitting on the side of that car. She's not hitting it hard enough to do damage to the car. And so I'm proceeding to write the check, the ticket, and I'm writing for speeding, and I run a check on the man's driver's license. It came back that his driver's license was suspended. I rolled my window down this moment, asked the woman to, just a little bit, asked the woman to step away from the car. Then I'm fixing to get out. I open the door. She follows me to the car. She's standing behind me. She's still screaming and hollering. I notify the man that his driver's license is suspended and ask him what he knows about that. He tells me that he's not aware that his license is suspended. I tell him I'm going to have to write him a citation for that. If they have another licensed driver in the car, that I will release the car for someone else to drive, and he can, you know, come to court on this court date. The woman's still trying to argue with me, and I'm trying to tell them I do not try cases on the side of the road. That's what the court system is for. I go back to my car. This woman's following me back to my car just as another policeman comes up to try to figure out what's taking me so long and just to check on me. And he sees this woman following me to my car. She's screaming. He decides to pull up and put himself in my stop. He approaches a woman, tells her she needs to get back into the car. She begins to curse him, scream at him. She's waving her arms around. He tells her she needs to get into her car. He's going to arrest her for disorderly conduct disturbing the peace. She continues to scream. He grabs her hand, puts a handcuff on one hand, starting to twist her around the pillow near. She's resisting arrest. And he continues, he bends her over the car, puts a handcuff on her, and puts her in the back of the car. Everything is proper as far as procedure, what can be done. We have a lot of discretion on these situations. I would have preferred for the officer to stay out of it, and because I felt no threat to myself at the time. But the woman was very loud. We noticed lights coming on in some of the houses on the street. And he also realized that it's not proper protocol to leave someone outside your car screaming at you and making all this racket. He goes and he takes this woman to the police station, and he questions her to find out, to make sure that she's not under any the influence of alcoholic beverages. He sees that she's, you know, well-dressed. She's just very irate. And the city I lived in, it was known in the press in the area. It was an all-white area. There was no blacks that lived within the city limits of this city. And so these people automatically, this woman's making this an issue. She's talking about this. It all has to do with race. He gives her a citation. And he asked me what is happening on my car. I told him there's other people in the car that have a driver's license. I've issued my citation. I'm going to release him. And, you know, so he brings the woman with her citation back to the car. And he lets them go. Now, the reason I mention this is because when I came to court, here I got a speeding ticket that's at least 15 miles north of the limit. I got a printout from a computer system that shows this man's been issued a speeding citation before. He didn't show up for court, and so his license, or he did show up for court, but he was issued time to pay for his fine. He didn't pay it, and so his license had been suspended. I have all this information. I go to court. It should be cut and dried. I walk into court. And they're having to put all these extra chairs around the side where the defense sits, and I'm trying to figure out what in the world is going on. And all of a sudden, I realize that there's 8 or 9 attorneys from the NAACP, which these people have been involved with working with, and they're trying to make this a racial case. Not to do, this man was definitely speeding, nothing to do with the printout that his license was suspended by the state of Arkansas. It was now all of a sudden, this all had to do with race. I look out and I see that there's two people from two news, local news stations in from Little Rock are there. The state newspaper has people there that are covering this. Other small newspapers are there. And where there's usually probably, except for the people that are there for cases, there's usually not very many people in the gallery on misdemeanor cases like this. It is full of several black people that have been bussed in by the NAACP to be part of this court case. Now, I'm of the mindset that it doesn't matter if you're white, purple, green, I don't care. The law is the law. You've been issued a citation, and so you should have to, whatever the law says is supposed to be the fine for that incident, you should be tried with it. I'm not prejudiced in any shape, form, or fashion. In my home, if you use the N-word, your mouth was washed out with soap. So it was one of those things that I was brought up that race was not... that's something you judge people by. Some of my best friends are black. Some of my best friends are Hispanic. Race is not one of those things that I look at as being something to judge people. I judge people by their personal actions. To make a long story short, with all this press and everything is there, the judge dismissed the citations I issued against this man, put him on probation for 6 months, said if he didn't have any more incidents, that they would just be completely dismissed off his record. Should have never happened that way. The officer that wrote the citation with the woman, he got crucified. Even though he wasn't violent with the woman, he instructed her in polite terms that she needed to get back into her car. He didn't do anything to mistreat this woman. It's a safety precaution for them and for yourself to handcuff someone. You're not supposed to put anyone in your car without handcuffs. That is just part of the policy for any police officer trained in the state of Arkansas. Before it was all said and over and done with, the police officer and what the court said was that policemen were fixtures. We were nothing more than like a light pole or nothing more than a fire hydrant. And so with no other people being right there on the street, this woman cannot be charged for disturbing the peace because we were... considered fixtures. Disorderly conduct was also dismissed in the same way, and since these charges were thrown out, the resisting arrest was also thrown out. There again, this had to do with people playing the race card. I do think that there's some things that happened past before I was, maybe when I was a little boy, because they had the riots and things back in the 60s, I'm aware of in Little Rock, where race was a factor in some of the things that happened with law enforcement and the black community. I'm very aware. I guess I shouldn't say black. It's funny, when I was a little boy, black people wanted to be called Negro, then it became black, and I guess now it's African American. So if I've offended anyone, please forgive me. I definitely don't want to offend anyone. I just want to put out some things here for people to look at to get your own perceptions based on your life and what you're going to hear here to come up with your own mindset as to what you think about all this. And so, Starla, I'm going to turn this back over to you. We're going to play some of these things for you, and then I look forward to hearing what everybody else has to say.
For those of you just joining us, a chapter closing in America Justice. George Zimmerman has been found not guilty on all counts. The crowds are dissipating. The verdict has been read. Sadly, Trayvon's family, his parents were not even in the courtroom. They didn't get enough notice. They weren't there when it was read. What will it all amount to in the end? That's for history to decide. But for many people who love our justice system, like myself, this has been a polarizing case, as clear as black and white. You first heard this when you got the phone call. What was your immediate thought?
Well, of course, you know that is the worst telephone call a mother can receive, is to tell her that her child has been shot and killed. I mean, Trayvon is my baby. He's my youngest son, and I just could not believe it. I was just in disbelief that he had been shot and killed. And I don't think we were given enough information as victims. Trayvon was a victim of senseless gun violence, and we wasn't given enough information. So to start with, he was shot and killed, and we didn't know exactly what happened. So it started off
on
the
wrong
foot.
The call, what were you told? Were you told that he was just missing to start with, that you couldn't find, they couldn't find him?
Yes, Tracy simply told me that he didn't come home that night and he didn't know where Trayvon was. He said that he was going to call his cousin and then he was going to call missing persons so he can report that he didn't come home. That's how it started.
Where were you?
I was actually at work on Monday the 27th. I was at work.
Where were you working then?
Miami-Dade County Housing Agency.
So you were just sitting at your desk and people were around you and you get a phone call that they can't find your son.
Right. I was at work. I was actually at work. I had been to work since 8 o'clock, and I was at my desk, and I got a call from Tracy on my cell phone, and he told me then that Trayvon hadn't come home. So I wasn't really alarmed at that time, but we, thought it was unusual that he had not come home. So by then, I was like, okay, just make some calls and try to find out what's going on. At that time, I told my supervisor, I have an emergency. I need to leave. I don't know what's going on with my son. My supervisor told me, no problem. Do what you need to do to find out where your son is, because I couldn't even work. I was like, where are you? I wonder where Trayvon is. So I couldn't even work. So I immediately left. I got in my car, and as I got in my car, I got the second call to tell me that Trayvon had been shot and killed.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Because I remember when Keith was murdered, I was told at first there had been an accident. And I thought everything was, upside. I didn't understand what had happened. I didn't get the whole truth. And so you're in the car driving, and you get the second call, and they tell you as you're driving that Trayvon is dead.
Yes.
What did you do?
I don't think it didn't sit in, because I was like doubtful that it was even him. I was like, are you sure? Do you know for sure if that's him? I didn't think it was him, because I thought that's impossible for him to, you know, just be dead at 17. I just...
Be dead?
No, I couldn't believe it. And I drove maybe a couple of miles, and it started to sit in, and I pulled over on the side of the street.
You first heard this. When you got the phone call, what was your immediate thought?
Well, of course you know.
Well, I want to come out here, first of all, to tell you that Jay is prepared for all your questions and is very much looking forward to the session. Second thing is I want to let you know that over the next couple of weeks, there are going to obviously be a whole range of issues, immigration, economics, et cetera. We'll try to arrange a fuller press conference to address your questions. The reason I actually wanted to come out today is not to take questions, but to speak to an issue that obviously has gotten a lot of attention over the course of the last week, the issue of the Trayvon Martin ruling. I gave a preliminary statement right after the ruling on Sunday, but watching the debate over the course of the last week, I thought it might be useful for me to expand on my thoughts a little bit. First of all, I want to make sure that once again I send my thoughts and prayers as well as Michelle's to the family of Trayvon Martin, and to remark on the incredible grace and dignity with which they've dealt with the entire situation. I can only imagine what they're going through, and it's remarkable how they've handled it. The second thing I want to say is to reiterate what I said on Sunday, which is there are going to be a lot of arguments about the legal issues in the case. I'll let all the legal analysts and talking heads address those issues. The judge conducted the trial in a professional manner. The prosecution and the defense made their arguments. The juries were properly instructed that in a case such as this, reasonable doubt was relevant, and they rendered a verdict. And once the jury's spoken, that's how our system works. But I did want to just talk a little bit about context and how people have responded to it and how people are feeling. You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that doesn't go away. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African-Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And I don't want to exaggerate this, but those sets of experiences inform how the African-American community interprets what happened one night in Florida. And it's inescapable for people to bring those experiences to bear. The African American community is also knowledgeable that there is a history of racial disparities in the application of our criminal laws. Everything from the death penalty to enforcement of our drug laws. And that ends up having an impact in terms of how people interpret the case. Now, this isn't to say that the African-American community is naive about the fact that African-American young men are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system, that they're disproportionately both victims and perpetrators of violence. It's not to make excuses for that fact, although black folks do interpret the reasons for that in a historical context. We understand that some of the violence that takes place in poor black neighborhoods around the country is born out of a very violent past in this country, and that the poverty and dysfunction that we see in those communities can be traced to a very difficult history. And so the fact that sometimes that's unacknowledged adds to the frustration. And the fact that a lot of African-American boys are painted with a broad brush and the excuse is given, well, there are these statistics out there that show that African-American boys are more violent. Using that as an excuse to then see sons treated differently causes pain. I think the African-American community is also not naive in understanding that statistically, somebody like Trayvon Martin was probably statistically more likely to be shot by a peer than he was by somebody else. So folks understand the challenges that exist for African-American boys. But they get frustrated, I think, if they feel that there's no context for it, and that context is being denied. And that all contributes, I think, to a sense that if a white male teen was involved in the same kind of scenario, that from top to bottom, both the outcome and the aftermath might have been different. Now, the question for me at least, and I think for a lot of folks, is where do we take this? How do we learn some lessons from this and move in a positive direction? I think it's understandable that there have been demonstrations and vigils and protests, and some of that stuff is just going to have to work its way through as long as it remains nonviolent. If I see any violence, then I will remind folks that that dishonors what happened to Trayvon Martin and his family. But beyond protests or vigils, the question is, are there some concrete things that we might be able to do? I know that Eric Holder is reviewing what happened down there, but I think it's important for people to have some clear expectations here. Traditionally, these are issues of state and local government. The criminal code and law enforcement is traditionally done at the state and local levels, not at the federal levels. That doesn't mean, though, that as a nation, we can't do some things that I think would be productive. So let me just give a couple of specifics that I'm still bouncing around with my staff, so we're not rolling out some five-point plan, but some areas where I think all of us could potentially focus. Number one, precisely because law enforcement is often determined at the state and local level, I think it would be productive for the Justice Department, governors, mayors, to work with law enforcement about training at the state and local levels in order to reduce the kind of mistrust in the system that sometimes currently exists. When I was in Illinois, I passed racial profiling legislation. And it actually did just two simple things. One, it collected data on traffic stops and the race of the person who was stopped. But the other thing was it resourced us training police departments across the state on how to think about potential racial bias and ways to further professionalize what they were doing. And initially, the police departments across the state were resistant, but actually they came to recognize that if it was done in a fair, straightforward way, that it would allow them to do their jobs better, and communities would have more confidence in them, and in turn be more helpful in applying the law. And obviously law enforcement's got a very tough job. So that's one area where I think there are a lot of resources and best practices that could be brought to bear if state and local governments are receptive. And I think a lot of them would be. And let's figure out, are there ways for us to push out that kind of training? Along the same lines, I think it'd be useful for us to examine some state and local laws to see if they are designed in such a way that they may encourage the kinds of altercations and confrontations and tragedies that we saw in the Florida case, rather than diffuse potential altercations. I know that there's been commentary about the fact that the stand your ground laws in Florida were not used as a defense in the case. On the other hand, if we're sending a message as a society in our communities that someone who is armed potentially has the right to use those firearms, even if there's a way for them to exit from a situation, is that really going to be contributing to the kind of peace and security and order that we'd like to see? And for those who resist that idea that we should think about something like these stand your ground laws, I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws. Number three, and this is a long-term project, we need to bolster and reinforce our African-American boys. And this is something that Michelle and I talk a lot about. There are a lot of kids out there who need help, who are getting a lot of negative reinforcement. And is there more that we can do to give them a sense that their country cares about them and values them and is willing to invest in them? I'm not naive about the prospects of some grand new federal program. I'm not sure that that's what we're talking about here, but I do recognize that as president I've got some convening power, and there are a lot of good programs that are being done across the country on this front. And for us to be able to gather together business leaders and local elected officials and clergy and celebrities and athletes and figure out how are we doing a better job helping young African American men feel that they're a full part of this society, and that they've got pathways and avenues to succeed. Yeah, I think that would be a pretty good outcome from what was obviously a tragic situation. And we're going to spend some time working on that and thinking about that. And then finally, I think it's going to be important for all of us to do some soul searching. You know, there have been talk about should we convene a conversation on race. I haven't seen that be particularly productive. When politicians try to organize conversations. They end up being stilted and politicized, and folks are locked into the positions they already have. On the other hand, in families and churches and workplaces, there's the possibility that people are a little bit more honest, and at least you ask yourself your own questions about, am I wringing as much bias out of myself as I can? Am I judging people as much as I can based on not the color of their skin, but the content of their character? That would, I think, be an appropriate exercise in the wake of this tragedy. And let me just leave you with a final thought, that as difficult and challenging as this whole episode has been for a lot of people, I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country. And so, you know, we have to be vigilant, and we have to work on these issues, and those of us in authority should be doing everything we can to encourage the better angels of our nature, as opposed to using these episodes to heighten divisions. But we should also have confidence that kids these days, I think, have more sense than we did back then, and certainly more than our parents did or our grandparents did, and that along this long, difficult journey, we're becoming a more perfect union. Not a perfect union, but a more perfect union. All right?
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Afterburner. I'm Bill Whittle. The NAACP compared the Trayvon Martin shooting to the lynching of Emmett Till in 1955, two young black men on their way to buy some candy being murdered for the crime of being black. Sirius XM radio host Joe Madison called the Martin shooting nothing more than a modern-day lynching. Well, he was right about that. An innocent person was tied to a tree, kind of a tree anyway, and destroyed before he could be tried, before any evidence was in. That's exactly what happened. Now, this People magazine cover summed up the case that got the guilty verdict against George Zimmerman, because the trial isn't important. The world found him guilty. A poor black child murdered in cold blood on the way to the 7-Eleven to buy some candy. Get a good look at this magazine cover. Really soak it in, because stories and covers like this one are evidence of one of two things on the part of the media: either criminal fraud or criminal negligence. Now, I'm not here to retry this case, but I am here to skim, and I mean skim, the volumes of credible material, often in Trayvon Martin's own words, that every major news organization simply ignored in order to tell this story. Weeks and months after the event, presumably reputable news sources presented a narrative that was sold to the world as news, journalistic truth. The truth is still there. It's the journalism that's gone. So let's put aside the sentiment for a moment. We'll come back to the sentiment and look at what we know. Daniel Patrick Moynihan once remarked, "You're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts." So where to begin? Well, you could start with these two pictures, run side by side virtually everywhere: the cherubic innocent boy and the scowling white Hispanic racist assassin. Everywhere, all the time. Well, first of all, let's start at the crime scene, because if you'd arrived there, and the police were in there about a minute after the shooting, you would not have seen this, but rather this. Trayvon Martin was not the child portrayed on the People magazine cover or in the hoodie, and you can tell that George Zimmerman has hardly assassinated a defenseless child from a distance. So, what did the media know or should have known about the two principals that they sat on in order to perpetuate the story? Well, let's start with Trayvon. That happy-looking boy on the People magazine cover really came apart, especially after his father's second divorce. He became active in mixed martial arts-style fighting, texting, for example, that he wanted a rematch with an opponent because, in his own words, the other guy hadn't bled enough. Witnesses testified that he was on top of Zimmerman at the time of the shooting, raining down what were called mixed martial arts style blows. We have screen grabs of Trayvon's texts, they're not airable here for extreme graphic content, that showed sexual aggression typical of hip-hop culture in America today. Anyone reading those texts would not describe Trayvon Martin as a sweet young child. He was violent and highly sexualized. And then things start to get even more serious, because a search of Trayvon's locker at school revealed a burglary tool and several pieces of stolen property, including jewelry. Incredibly, well, it would have been incredible at one time, Dade County school officials decided to list that as found property rather than stolen property. If they listed it as stolen property, a police report would have been required, which would reflect badly on black crime rates in the school system, so it was ignored. Now, nevertheless, Trayvon had been suspended several times for behavioral issues in the months leading up to the shooting. And then there's the issue of the candy and the iced tea. Now, we were told that Trayvon, again, an innocent child, simply went to the store to buy some candy and some iced tea. But it wasn't just any candy, and it wasn't iced tea. It was Skittles candy and a drink called Arizona Watermelon Fruit Juice Cocktail. Here's the can found at the shooting scene. The prosecution continually kept up this deception by referring to this drink as iced tea, and some have speculated that they did so to avoid the racial stereotype of black people and watermelon, but there's a much better explanation. Because if you take Arizona Watermelon Fruit Juice Cocktail, a bag of Skittles, and add simple cough syrup, you get a cheap codeine-based drink called Lean. Now, there's an entire online subculture devoted to the use of lean, which Trayvon was familiar with. We have screen grabs of him trying to score some codeine online and instead being told he could make some fire-ass lean using cough syrup, Skittles, and Arizona Watermelon Fruit Juice Cocktail. Seems a bit of a coincidence to me that the only two items he picked up out of the entire 7-Eleven were two-thirds of the ingredients needed to make lean. Now, additionally, we have a report from his autopsy that reveal a form of liver damage in this otherwise healthy young man just a few days short of 18 that are consistent with the kind of trauma that excessive lean usage does to an otherwise healthy liver. Now, most importantly, the online subculture refers to a number of psychological symptoms associated with the use of lean, the two most prominent being extreme physical aggression and paranoia. And we could do this for hours. So what about Zimmerman, the arch-racist who shot an innocent boy in cold blood? Well, he was raised alongside of two black children. Black members of his community testified he was the only person of any race or color that came up and introduced himself when they moved into the neighborhood. And when a homeless black man named Sherman Ware was knocked down by the son of a Sanford police officer, George Zimmerman, and only George Zimmerman, was so outraged by this assault that he printed up flyers and continued to do so until the son of the policeman was charged with the assault on the homeless black man. The FBI told Eric Holder's Justice Department civil rights cases against Zimmerman would fail because not only was there no evidence that he was a racist, there was a preponderance of evidence that he was not. His was not a white gated community, but a multicultural one, and one in which he seems to have been pretty nearly universally liked and admired. A breakdown of the times and distances between the video recording of Trayvon in the 7-Eleven, the 911 call, and the time of the shooting showed that Trayvon was not being pursued by Zimmerman. He had had ample time to reach his destination, about 4 minutes to go 100 yards. Trayvon had actually gone about 30 yards in that time. He was waiting for Zimmerman. Now, maybe the lean had made him paranoid and aggressive. We don't know. That's speculation. But what isn't speculation is that George Zimmerman was lying on the ground calling repeatedly for help. Why would he call for help if he was determined to kill this person? With Trayvon Martin, who was several inches taller, astride him, raining down mixed martial arts blows and telling him he was going to die that night. And when Trayvon started bashing his skull against the cement, Zimmerman thought, pretty reasonably, in my opinion, that if he didn't act, he would indeed die that night. Which is why the police did not charge him and refused to charge him until the President and Attorney General of the United States brought overwhelming political pressure in contradiction of all the evidence for a prosecution. Now remember, no one in the jury was allowed to know about the lien, the burglary, the altered mental state, the history of violence, none of it. And they acquitted George Zimmerman anyway. Those are the facts. How do we know this? Is it because of the in-depth reporting of the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Miami Herald? No. None of them were interested in any of this. Most of this comes to light through the internet and among many dedicated researchers, especially the works of Jack Caschle at American Thinker and Sundance at the Conservative Treehouse. Now, I know some of you are snorting, Conservative Treehouse, American Thinker, typical right-wing liars, but the problem with that is this is not speculation. It's Trayvon Martin in his own words. Go look. It's screen grabs of his texts. It's his own Facebook posts. It's the actual autopsy report. It's sourced. It's evidence. It's called journalism. There's no journalism in places like the New York Times. These facts were available to anyone. That a few individuals could find them without resources and without pay proves that there's no journalism in places like the New York Times. You know, the definition of tragedy is something terrible that didn't have to happen. Should George Zimmerman have gotten out of his truck that night? I think of all the people in the world saying no, he would be at the top of the list. And if it weren't for the political correctness, Trayvon Martin might have gotten charged with his earlier burglaries. Would that have scared him or his parents into changing his direction? No one knows. Now, after the verdict, this image appeared. It's meant to connect Trayvon Martin with Martin Luther King. And of all the things in this wretched lynching of George Zimmerman, this is the most disgraceful. Why is there a Martin Luther King Day and not, say, a Jesse Jackson Day or an Al Sharpton Day or a Louis Farrakhan Day? Well, Dr. King is revered because he preached inclusion and nonviolence. Martin Luther King thrilled us with his I Have a Dream speech, and the entire point, not only of the speech, but his entire life's work was summed up with these lines. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will be not judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. The people that are pushing this narrative of a racist assassin and an innocent black child, the judge and prosecutors in the worst kangaroo court in living memory, did everything in their power to make certain that no one knew anything about the content of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin's character, and only knew about one thing and one thing only, and that is the color of their skin. To connect Martin Luther King to this travesty is an outrage, and it's disgusting. It's perpetrated by outrageous and disgusting people. And if all of this political power and journalistic malfeasance can be deployed to sell a tortured lie, as in the case of this little story, then what political power and journalistic malfeasance do you think might be deployed in making the spy a much...
Well, this is not about opinion. You know, I brought you Nancy Grace, who kind of does the drama thing, which a lot of the press did on the far side during the trial, trying to point people's minds in one direction. I didn't play any of the preacher's clips that were sitting there taking an excerpt from the president's speech and making it sound like he was trying to stir up racial strife. Once again, I gave you the whole speech. You can look at it for yourself. I shared with you Afterburner. Really like how they did a short thing. Sorry you couldn't see the pictures that he was showing, but he was showing how they showed this young man being a young, innocent, you know, beautiful child like all children are. And then they showed that the photo of the man in jail that killed him, and which those photographs are never flattering. But the thing here is not about your opinion of what's right and what's wrong. To me, as people of faith, when we look at this, I'm so reminded when Matt Maddox came up here and the information that he provided for us as to about how many people in prison don't have fathers, how many people that are in prison come from homes that live in poverty. When the world out there is showing people that unless you can become a super athlete, that you're stuck where you are. Where you got people that you see your parents working two and three jobs from where their good middle class or upper job has disappeared to try to make ends meet, and people are still losing their home by the millions. You look at things and you think, okay, as a person of faith, what can I do? There's this world out here, and with Matt Maddox, he has this program where they go out and they feed the poor. And while they're there, they let their light shine. They're not telling these people about Jesus. They're showing the love of Jesus that's inside of them as they go out and they work with these poor people. They go into the neighborhoods where children are disadvantaged, and they reach out to them, and they have these Holy Ghost services, because these kids have no history, no prior knowledge of anything to do with the power of God living inside of them. But they understand two words. They understand what a gift is, and they understand what a promise is. And so in faith they accept those things. And I was able to witness firsthand how these children, their life was changed. The seed of God was planted inside of them. So I just want everybody to kind of, as we go playing the card that says, I blame the president, I blame the government, I blame law enforcement, I blame society. You know, no one wants to take anything personal anymore. It's always this blame game. I ask you to just think within yourself, how many times do I try to reach out to individuals that's not part of my so-called group that I'm comfortable to deal with, the people that come into my church? When do I go out into the community and try to be that salt and light that I'm called to be? But again, this is not about my opinion on this. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And so, Starla, just if you would, open up the mics, and I'd love to hear what everyone has to say.
Wow, that was really eye-opening. I hadn't heard a lot of things because it wasn't reported in the media. So most of that stuff I didn't know. You had to just draw your own conclusions from the pictures that the media was painting, and really that's all we had to go by. Blog Talk Mom.
Right. I hear what you're saying, Sister Starla. I appreciate you and Wild Bill for bringing this together tonight. I avoid a lot of, I just avoid newspapers, news, and I'm interested in the news, but I've just seen so many times that we only hear what people want us to hear. You know, we don't.
Mm-hmm.
So while Bill put together tonight some perceptions, insights that I wasn't aware of, but I can certainly see how it could be exactly like that, because you've got, I think our president covered it beautifully. It's going to be, according to, if you're in the black community, then you know the history that goes on there. I just thought that was so just honest. It was just such an honest way of saying what he said. And then, of course, we know, any of us that I was raised in, my school years were in Detroit, Michigan, and it was right after they had a large riot there. And I had just moving from a little town in Arkansas, it was just like moving into an entire, well, it was, moving into a different culture, a different world, a different language, everything about it. And I had a lot of opinions and made a lot of mistakes during those times that I lived in junior high school especially. And then the problems they had in Little Rock, when Governor Faubus and all of that, when they were trying to integrate the schools, that was just so much hatred, so many just cruel, no compassion. And, you know, I heard a statement one time years ago, and it was in a Christian school that I attended, and it said that man's inhumanity to man, man's inhumanity to his fellow man, is the most puzzling thing in the world. How we can hurt someone when we know how it feels to be hurt. You know, how we can just close the door of compassion on someone that's hurting. And I have a situation where I just can't pass anybody up that's begging on the street. If there's any way possible, I've got to go back and I've got to do something. And people have sort of made fun of the fact that I'm that way. But in my heart, I know that God watches. And if he says that if just a cup of water that he places in our hand, if we give that, then he's aware of that. That's not the scripture, but that's the context of it. And I've never been sorry. There's been some times that people have taken advantage of that, but I know that God is keeping an account. And what our president said is, instead of anger and fighting and wanting to retaliate and find fault and judge, let's do something about the problem. And there's a book that I recommend any and everybody to read. It's called The Fields of the Fatherless. It's a small book. It's by C. Thomas Davis. You can get it at Amazon, order it, and Fields of the Fatherless. And when you see what some families and some children have had to come up under, the pressures, the poverty, just all of the different things, if you just ask the Lord, God, I want to love that individual. I want to be your hand. If we're the body of Christ, you know, where are the hands? You know, what are we doing when God is placed in our power to help those? And I want to mention the clubhouse that we had for 3 years. It was, I didn't fill up a church full of people. I didn't see a lot, really. I didn't see a lot of results from it. But I know that I did what God wanted me to do. And if everyone listening is still finding this is a wonderful program, you know, there's something each one of us can do each day. There's that divine appointment. There's some place somewhere that God can place us in towards a nursing home or someone, just wherever, but especially in young people's lives. And I appreciate this program. I don't have anything that creative to say, to add to it, but I definitely appreciate everything that I heard tonight. Thank you very much.
Well, I enjoyed the facts that I haven't heard. I mean, sometimes you don't even know who to root for because you don't really know the whole story. And I don't know why our media has to be so jaded, and why, I don't know, why the facts have become so unimportant.
I think they're important. I think that there are so many factions that are so volatile. Like while Bill was talking about the court situation, it changed completely from the complexion of what was going on to a whole different thing. And so I'm not judging that situation. I just know that, like our president said, if you put it before a political or a media situation to try to find out what we should do, it's just God commended that to the church, to the families. You know, that's the ones that can, maybe we can lay down our swords. And I understand now why the Bible says they'll, you know, during the millennial reign, that there won't be any fighting and killing and wars, and there's just got to be that time that we love and we have compassion, but to really be aware that the media has many agendas, many, and I know Smith Wigglesworth, one of the great apostolic leaders and a minister, great, great man of God, and he said he would not allow anyone to even bring a newspaper in his home. He said that the influence was just so non-truthful. In fact, he said it was just pages of lies, and that may be a radical statement, but we do need to be aware. Don't you think, Sister Starla, just maybe not to judge or panic in any way, but be aware that we're mm-hmm. not judge things just according to what we hear on the news or see on a broadcast. That's maturity and awareness.
But I am really guilty of believing into the things that are shown without getting the whole facts. And Lisa, my daughter, you know, she, when I ask her if something is true or I present it as truth, she'll direct me to a website that shows, you know, the real story. And she'll let me know that what I've heard isn't the truth at all. And it makes me feel so foolish that I've believed or bought into the things that that's been presented as truth. We have Wild Bill with us. Wild Bill?
Thank you guys for your comments on the show. You know, one of the things that the guy Afterburner said at the end there that really hits home if we stop and think about it. Here we got a simple case, and it's a tragic case, but if the news can be twisted as much as it was twisted on this, what other more serious issues are taking place in this great country of ours that they're doing this twist to, that we're swallowing a lie, that we're enjoying being fed the dirty laundry, like the song said at the beginning? And it's thought-provoking. But there again, in the Bible, it talks about where evil is spoken of as good and good is spoken of as evil. And why should we be surprised that the media is one of the places where this is happening? You know, I disagree with the president where he tried to get the federal authorities involved in this case, but they quickly said that there was no wrongdoing. So it wasn't like a witch hunt. They came, investigated, said, hey, we have no federal case. And so that pleased me. But I still believe that in our court system today, that when you're found not guilty, we have a law called double jeopardy, and we can't play this game of all of a sudden making it a federal crime, because someday in our near future, we could see to where at our state and local level, where, you know, your church people still have some control with your peers, to where you're not held guilty of something having to do with your religious faith, but all of a sudden at the federal level, a prosecutor come in and say, well, you violated federal law, here we're going to charge you for a federal crime for your religious faith. And we believe that that can happen in our country, but as the day that things are changing so much, I believe that it's just shortly that if we're not careful, we're going to see these things in our lifetime happening. So I'm not trying to paint a picture of gloom and doom, because of the internet, there is so many resources where you can look at both sides and then come up with your, because even the other side has their own slant of things. Sometimes it goes way too far to the left or right. But in looking at both sides of the situation, hearing the entire transcripts of something instead of just the thing they click out and want to share with you because I got so much stuff to put on the news, that's where we can keep our head out of the sand. And when we say something, we can have an assurance that we based it on our opinion from our perceptions based on all the facts. And look at things being a clear picture as to what it is, instead of where someone has told us. They've done their own interpretation of what a picture is. So thank you, Blog Talk Mom, for your comments there, because I know that even though I remember some of the things that happened back in the 60s, and I've seen the government housing in Detroit, Michigan that was burnt during the time you were talking about with the riots that were there, and the federal government punished those people. They just didn't rebuild them. And the actual brutality that was committed by law enforcement against the blacks during that time, that's very real. And so not being black, it's hard for me to have a perception of that that's not looking at it kind of like it's just news. It's not a reality to me because I wasn't part of it. My family wasn't part of it. But for those that their family was part of it, I can't imagine what that feels like. So, Charlotte, did we have anybody else that had a comment or a question or anything?
Does anybody else have something that they want to say? Comment? No? I think some people just try to stay away from the politics of things like this, because sometimes it is so political, the way it's skewed.
Yeah, and I have a lot of friends that they don't want to talk about this because no matter what you say, they're going to disagree with anything that our president has to say because they've bought into some of the things that's been said about him. And there is some things to cause concern, but, you know, we've tried to be fair in just presenting the whole speech and letting you interpret it how you want to. We don't edit it. We don't change the wording. We don't give you our perception. We let you hear the whole thing. And so there's a lot of things about the man that you may not like, but judging for the things that are factual, not the things that you're hearing. But there's a lot of people that can't be wrong. You know, it's, well, this guy, I don't agree with him. I'm Republican, and I believe what the Republicans say, and so anything this man says, as far as I'm concerned, is of the devil. You know, it's just the way some people look at things. And so I can understand, you know, not wanting to get involved and make a comment there to say, wow, that was some speech. You know, I really felt like he was trying to be more the peacemaker than the stirring up and agitating, as I was first, you know, led to believe. You know, they don't, people don't want to open up and say that. And I can understand that. We do that in denominational faith. There are certain things that no matter what you say, we're going to say you're wrong because you don't believe like we do, or maybe on something about being baptized or something regarding the gift of the Holy Ghost. We have a tendency not to accept anything those people have to say, which is sad because I've tried to get people on our show that actually are from different denominations to let us see that maybe they can share something with us that we're missing on grace, or we're missing something on the love of God, because there's a lot of churches that are really doing things to reach out to the poor, to reach out to those that are in need, spending all kinds of resources that's not going to be regrouped as something to gain finance into their church. You know, they're doing it because that's what they're supposed to do. And so we can all learn from each other, and we don't put anybody down for having different, you know, perceptions or thought process on any of these issues. You know, as I shared at the beginning, you know, I worked in law enforcement, so, my, you know, my opinion is going to be a little skewed. I had that one incident I shared with the NAACP. So I saw firsthand how the law became second to the stress and pressure that could be applied by an organization. And it's just, as flawed in some ways as our system is, it's still the best that there is in the world. And I thank God that I was born in the United States of America. I thank God for our country. I thank God we have people that are willing to step out and put their lives in harm's way to defend our country and what our country believes in. And I'm thankful we have these freedoms today that we can go out on Blog Talk Radio and thousands of people can hear maybe something different from us that they would hear anywhere else. And we only have that because of where we live, and I'm so thankful for it. And I thank all of you guys that take time to listen and be a part of our show.
Amen. Sometimes we take those freedoms for granted. You know, the other countries, there are other countries, many other countries, that don't have the freedoms that we do, that, I don't know, maybe we're taking them for granted less because they're so threatened lately.
Just to say that, again, I want to thank you both for taking your time. I know it takes a lot of time to bring this out, the different viewpoints, and to support it with allowing the people to say these things. And I agree, too, with what you were saying, while Bill, about we stereotype, like in religion, a group, and we put them in, you know, that little box, and we do that with races and with cultures and with, and to me, I watched a video of the last speech of Martin Luther King. To me, it was one of the most dynamic impressions upon my life that it's ever been, and just. George Washington Carver. We can sometimes get this stereotyped of poor black people and all of this, but oh, there has been so many tremendous role models, and I agree with the last speaker that you had, Wild Bill, to not put them all the criminal in with the just because of a color or a race. You know, put them all. Because, if we did that, we'd all be in trouble. But thank you again. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, Bill, did you have anything else? I think we lost Wild Bill. Yep. Well, we want to thank everybody for listening tonight, and we really appreciate the emails and the comments that you send to Wild Bill, and I guess we'll say goodnight, and we'll see you here again next week at your place. Goodnight.